women walk in. I was thinking maybe Dee just asked me to come up here so she'd have some company with you guys. My sobriety date is October 3rd, 1990. I had my last drink December 13th, 1985. And I'll explain that as I go along, but you all taught me that sobriety means a little more than being alcohol free. I started drinking when I was about 13, and up until that time I was gangly and freckly and very socially inaccessible. I was afraid of people. I was afraid of interaction with everyone. I had not done well socially in school. I came from a kind of abusive background, and mostly what we did in our home was be quiet and stay out of the way. And I met someone when I was 13 years old that gave me alcohol, and everything changed. I rounded out my edges, that smoothed right off, and I found out that I could talk to people, and I could interact with people. I could have a good time, and I could dance. And I had not been able to dance before. I have developed a real joy for that, and one can do that in sobriety too, by the way. I married the person that gave me my first drink. I mean, that's what we do. And we drank together for a while. This was a long time ago. It was in the 60s, and at that time we had the Bay of Pigs going on. And so my husband went off to Cuba, and I drank while he was gone, minimally. When he came back, I thought that now I can really drink. Now I'm all grown up. I've got to understand, I'm 16 years old. I'm all grown up, and I can drink like the grown-ups, and I don't have to go to school, and I don't have to have anybody push me around or tell me anything. All I got to do is get along with this guy, and I can just be drunk. Well, I didn't do well with that, because when I would drink, I would act out. Never remembered it. I was here with you all for quite some time before I found out that everybody did not black out when they drank. I thought that was part of it. When you drank, you simply did not remember things. And I didn't know that was part of alcoholism. I would do ever things, and we lived on a military base, and we can't do that there. It got him in a lot of trouble. It got us in a lot of trouble, and so I had to leave. I left him there. We were in South Carolina, and I returned to California. I was raised on the West Coast. My people were. And so I went back out there, and I replaced him with somebody who would drink with me. And I married him, and we drank together for a long time. And he went to Vietnam, whatever was going on then. And I continued to drink, and then I got into some harder things. I was introduced to some heavy drugs. And I didn't drink so much for a few years. By then I was about 17 years old. And I met my next mate. He was a Hell's Angel. And he was involved with heroin and dealt drugs, and taught me how to use that. And I did that for a while. And the drinking took a back seat to it because I could stay kind of anesthetized. And eventually I was incarcerated for heroin use. And they called it treatment, but in the 60s they didn't know anything about treatment. We didn't have treatment centers like we do now, where you can play volleyball till your insurance runs out. We had prisons where they put you and kept you abstinent after the fact. Some of us were abstinent. And it was just on the other side of the correctional facility. It was just another wing. They still had correctional officers. They still had gun towers. They still had all the things that we have in our prisons today. And they didn't know anything really about treatment. They had what we call group therapy now for an hour a day, and so they defined it as treatment. I stayed there a couple of years. And when I got out of there, what I had learned was that I didn't ever want to be that afraid again. I was deathly afraid all the time I was in there. I did not use anything while I was in there. But I never could take a shower by myself. I never could go anywhere alone because people got hurt a lot there. And it was real frightening. And I knew I didn't want to live like that. Didn't have anything to do with drugs, didn't have anything to do with addiction, because my belief is alcoholism is a disease and drug addiction is something that we give ourselves. You can addict a rat to something if you inject him with it. You cannot make an alcoholic out of a rat unless he is an alcoholic and allergic to alcohol. So I did not put any more heroin in me and therefore was no longer a heroin addict. But I had to replace the need to cover up who I was and what I did. So I went back to drinking. You know, that's legal and you can do that. And they don't arrest you unless you wreck cars, run over people, break the law. You can get real drunk and you can act real bad. And nobody puts you in jail. They get tired of you. But they will let you drink yourself to death in this country. It is legal to drink yourself completely to death and no one will interfere with you. And so that's what I set out to do. I was going to drink and it was going to be okay. And by then my Hell's Angel was down in prison for some hard times. So I had to replace him and I found whoever was next and I married him. And he drank like I did. For years we drank together. We had a daughter. And most of that time in my life was very, very foggy. I really, really regret that. I don't remember a lot of her childhood. I remember different incidents. I remember small spaces of time, but there are great gaps in my recollection when my daughter was growing up. Because I was drunk. I was drunk all the time. Finally, that husband couldn't stand me anymore. You know, what's interesting about us, like I said, he drank like I did. But he didn't do the things I did. He did not find himself unable to take care of a family, have a job, do the things that socially acceptable people do. He just went out and had a good time. He got drunk a lot, passed out a lot, and went to work the next day and paid the bills and did the things that people are expected to do. I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't keep a job. I could not function. There were great phases of time when I was just not functional at all. And so he had to go away from me. For a while, he let me keep our daughter. And I had gone through a whole litany of wrecking cars. That was my thing. I wrecked everything that I ever got into. Put a key in. I ran it off the bridges, under bridges, into telephone poles. No matter what it was, I had to wreck it. And I think he got scared that I would kill her. And so he came and saw her, and that was best. And she lived with him, and I would go and visit her there. And that was all right. They were pretty nice to me. They let me come in their home and enjoy her when I was sober enough to be aware that I was there. But I couldn't take her. Then I kept drinking. I kept going downhill. I was just unable to keep a job at all. I would work a while and go out the back door because I couldn't show up for work. Couldn't get up. I couldn't function. I couldn't stay together. I couldn't work without drinking. I was sneaking back in the back room drinking while I was at work. I never got fired for drinking. When I got here, that was real important to me. I heard some of you all talking about that. I lost a lot of jobs to alcohol. See, I didn't think I ever lost a job to alcoholism because they never fired me for being drunk. I always quit. I always went out the back door. I left just ahead of the hammer falling. So for me, that didn't fit. I looked for all the ways that I was different from you, all the ways that I wasn't like you because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I have a friend who says all the time, I wanted to be crazy because crazy people can drink. I didn't want to be an alcoholic because I would have to stop. And that kind of fit me. You know, I didn't mind being crazy. I've been locked up in some nut wards. I had a few of those armed bands. And I had been a lot of places, hospitals. I had, we wrecked a lot of cars, take a lot of hospitals. When you behave like a mad woman, they take you to a lot of mental institutions. So I've had a lot of observation from one place to the next. So I decided that I needed some outside help. You know, I was aware that I needed a power outside myself, even then, to stop me from drinking. So I went out and I found the biggest, meanest, ugliest man I could find, and this was my power outside myself. And I thought, well, he can stop me from drinking. And he almost beat me to death, but he could not stop me from drinking. I learned to drive a truck, because that's what he did, and we went on the road together, and I would sneak off, I would disappear anytime I could, any way I could, to get drunk. Well, this man didn't drink at all, he didn't understand anybody who did, and so that got real, real violent. It went way, way down, way, way past acceptable, just slamming people against the walls. It was bad. I was hospitalized a few times. And we went on forward. He went away one weekend, and I got real, real drunk. And he came home, and I was in bed, but I was just fried. And he assaulted me. And at that point, this is important, I think, for new people to share. At that point, I was not doing anything wrong. I was just drunk, which is legal in this country to be in your own home. Wasn't causing any disturbance, was in my own home. And when my husband assaulted me, he left and then he came back and he thought I was bleeding to death. I was severely harmed. So he took me to an emergency room. And he checked me in there, and he told those people that I got into a bar fight, and that was how I got hurt. And then he left. He left to stay. And I was in the hospital quite a while before anybody believed my story. See, he was sober, and I was drunk, and so I had no credibility. When we're drunk, even when we're right, we're wrong. It doesn't matter what we say. Nobody hears us. Nobody believes us. So that kind of got to me a little bit. I knew that I didn't want to keep living like that, and I healed up in the hospital. And I was there long enough. I was detoxed when I came out. I went right back out and drank again. And I got in another accident. And this man and I had a little boy. He was about 2 years old. I was going to the daycare center to pick him up, and I hit a telephone pole and took the whole side of my car out. Where he was then sitting, beside the entrance he was. And I don't know, maybe those people at the daycare center would have been smart enough not to give him to me. Maybe they would have given it to me. If they had, he'd have been dead and he wouldn't have had him today. That didn't stop me. I kept on drinking. They took me to jail for that one, and after the hospital and patching me up, they took me to jail a little time for that. And I got out and I drank some more. I mean, I immediately drank some more. And finally I ran off a cliff. I was out drunk one night, and I ran off a cliff in Arkansas. The Arkansas River has really deep, it's a transportation river. They run barges down it, so it's very deep right from the bank. It goes down about 35, 40 feet. And I ran over the cliff and down to the bank of the river. And I had a civil car, and it hung on something and didn't go in, but I was slanted down face in the water. And I knew that I was probably going to die. I had this, like, almost sobered up there for a moment. There were no skid marks when they checked the accident. There were no skid marks. I was not cognizant when I went over, but I remember being airborne. I don't remember hitting the ground. When I came to, I wanted to get out of the car. I wanted to get out of there bad. I could see the water, and I was trapped in there. The car wouldn't start. It was had electric doors, electric windows. You couldn't get out. And the doors were kind of bent. Couldn't move them. Couldn't get the windows down. And I was scared. Now I've almost been beaten to death, and that didn't scare me. I almost killed my child, and that didn't scare me. Now I'm scared. I think I'm going to drown. Now I'm really, really scared, and I don't want to die. And I had one of those, like, moments of clarity that we get in a phrase. And I've heard speakers saying, that those prayers we pray, those really desperate prayers we pray at the end of our drinking, are probably the sanest, most sincere prayers any of us ever pray. Well, maybe they are. I prayed if God would get me out of not drink anymore. Please just help me not drink. And it was the first time I had asked God to help me not drink. And they pulled me out of there and they took me to the hospital and to jail. You know, the whole litany of the thing, back to the cycle. And when I got out of there, I did not drink. I was detoxed by the time I got out of the jail and the hospital. So I did not have the compulsion to drink. I didn't have the physical allergy in force, but my mind was not that of a well person. And I didn't know what to do, but since I had started this pathway by prayer, I thought maybe that they could help me in a church. So I went and found a church, and I spent a lot of time there. I was in church every time they opened the doors. I was on my knees all the time. I about wore the carpet out in front of the pulpit. And I constantly was praying that God would heal me from this insanity. I didn't know I had alcoholism. I didn't understand alcoholism. I had been exposed to AA. I had heard people say things, but I just didn't really hear it. I just wasn't ever really cognizant. And so I went to church for about 5 years, between 1985 and 1990. Didn't drink. Took a lot of prescription drugs. I was married to a truck driver who, by the way, was also a career criminal, very bad man, moved around a lot. And when you move around a lot, then you get to, you change geographically. So all the doctors in town don't know you. You know, you can go to the doctor and get a righteous prescription for anything. Yeah. Can right now. Right now tonight I can go to the doctor and get one if I want it. And all you got to do is tell them you hurt. And I didn't know that I was just maintaining my disease. I had no idea. I was in AA quite a while before I realized that was why I had not had a drink during that time. When I got here, I thought I'd been sober for 5 years. I was nuts, but I thought I'd been sober. So anyway, I went around. I got all these pills, and I was just real, real sick. And my husband moved up to Florida, my son and I, and he went to jail. And I was not functional. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know how to take care of my boy. And I was really scared. And since I'd been involved in the church where we were before, I found a church. And I took my little boy, who was a real problem, terrible, terrible, violent, acting out little boy, took him to the pastor for counseling. And that went on for a little while. Finally, the pastor called me in and talked to me. And he asked me, have you ever tried AA? And I was extremely offended. And, you know, I don't drink. And I'm looking at my kid and I'm wanting to kill him. Are you telling this guy I'm drinking? And he's full of rage. He says, I don't know. You know, and he says, I think maybe you ought to try AA. And he kept on telling me that. And I didn't get it. But he was convinced that the problem was not the boy, the problem was the mother. And through the course of our conversation, he shared with me that he was a recovering person, that he had found help in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he suggested that maybe I would come to the meeting that went on at his church and just try it. You know, what could I lose but an hour? And that was how he put it to me. How much time are you willing to put into this? You know, you're coming over here with this kid to see me, so why don't you just take an hour and try? And the first meeting I went to, an old home. I knew I belonged there. I did not know if you guys were going to let me stay. Now that I was real concerned because they hadn't drank in a long time, and I thought, well, the criteria for being here, I might not meet that. You know, you might just not let me stay in here. As I listened a while, I started to remember, started to clear up. Way back in the late 60s, I was in jail in San Diego, California, and a young girl, I was, I don't know, 18, 19 years old. And I went to an AA meeting there. A little old lady handed me a half a cup of coffee and was very, very nice to me. And they read all the same things we read here, and I didn't hear them. I didn't even understand the implication of a half a cup. I just sat in there and shook and, you know, thought, well, at least I got out of the cell. And a while later out on the West Coast in the early 70s, I was court ordered to AA for a 90 meeting. And I went to 90 meetings. Most of them I went drunk. I did not remember what they read there. I did not remember what they said there. But they did let me come and they let me sit. So So I had been given the message, but I didn't absorb the message. I guess it was in there when I needed it. And when I came back, and I call it coming back, I was never a practicing recovering person, but at least I was exposed to recovering. When I came back to you all, I needed something. I knew I needed something because I was going to die. I was dying of the insanity of alcohol, and I was about to either drink or do myself in, and I didn't quite need any of those options much. And I kept coming to meetings. I just kept coming. I didn't grasp a whole lot. I didn't hear or understand a lot. It looked like, from the outside, that a lot of people were doing okay, that they had put together lives, that they were able to laugh some, and I had not laughed in years, and certainly not at myself, did not even realize that the problem was me. I felt so disguised. You know, I made a few bad choices. I was so disguised. We were always around, and you know, if you just weed them out, everything would be okay. And they wouldn't leave me alone, you know. They kept hanging around, coming back. You know how they do, you know, don't you? And we can't seem to get rid of the guys. I just kept on coming and sitting down. I found some ladies that were willing to tell me the truth even when I didn't want to hear it, and willing to let me cry until I stopped crying. And when finally I stopped having to cry all the time, they would sit down and they would just say to me, "This is what I hear you say, but this is what I see you do. And we have a program of recovery here, and it is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And initially, we have to admit that we are powerless over alcohol, and our lives are unmanageable." Well, I didn't have a whole lot of trouble with lives are unmanageable. I could kind of look over my shoulder and realize that there was some unmanageability there. And I never had had any power. Never had had any power. Went through my whole life looking for somebody to take responsibility for me, somebody to give me power, somebody to be empowered and just leave me around, just take care of me. So I was real grateful to realize that all I had to do was just keep asking God, and he would just relieve the insanity. I guess if I have a favorite step, it's that one, the reality that I don't have to be insane anymore. Being insane is scary. You know, I'm not going back to drinking. If I go back, I'm not going back to drinking dancing on tables at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not going back to drinking, having a good time. There's no sitting at cocktail parties with my finger in the air and a wine glass in my hand. I'm going back to the four horsemen on that bed. I'm going back to being scared. Going back to that horrible, horrible pain inside of me and no way to get free of it. That's what got me here. That terror, that bewilderment, that fear. I had all those things, but I didn't know that you guys had, because you looked pretty good on the outside. And I had to clear up a whole lot to realize there was anybody that was as sick as me anywhere in the world. I couldn't see past me. The big book tells me self-centeredness is one of the primary characteristics of my disease. Well, certainly I was self-centered. I was unhappy, and it was your fault, and all these things were wrong with me, and if you would just do right, they wouldn't be. So I was so wrapped up in my own person, my own self, that I couldn't see outside of me. I became willing to let God take care of me. And I think that's, you know, that's how we kind of jump off into the steps. We recognize that we have no power. We find the power. And then we just release all of our difficulties to that power and let him take control. And that doesn't mean that God holds my horn. You know, I have to do some things. I have to operate. I have to get up and go to work. God lets me have the job. I have to go do the work. God lets me have the gifts, but I have to take care of them, and whenever I don't take responsibility for them and I don't take care of them, I'm not happy. I had to do the fourth step, and I personally overwhelm wasn't enough. I didn't know enough. I couldn't look deeply enough because I was real complicated, you know, and had a lot of pain in me. So I could just look at me on a superficial level. But that cleaned up enough so that I could live to get a little deeper. So I did a fourth step, and then I had to do a fifth step. And, you know, I didn't want to do that one at all. I did not want to do a fifth step. I did not mind the deal of if I write it down and, like, hide it in the book. But write it. What if a burglar came in and read that? What if somebody saw these things? And then you have to sit down in a room with somebody, a human being, and you have to tell them all this stuff. And that just fried me. I did not want to say out loud the things that I had done to anybody. I didn't want to admit it. You got to remember, I was in the church for 5 years before I got here. So I cleaned up my act. I wasn't quite as arrogant. I wasn't quite as nasty. And I didn't want to admit just how bad I'd been or how much I'd done. It was incredible to me to release myself because I found somebody in my life that I could identify with who would give me just enough of herself so that I would know that I was a part of instead of a part from. And that was a big thing for me, to be connected to people. I'd never been connected to anybody in my life. I don't know that I was even really connected to my children before AA. I always felt like there was a glass window between me and everybody else, and I just couldn't get from me to you. I saw other people do it or say they were doing it, and I always wondered if it was sort of like a soap opera, you know, and when you got out of sight, you took it off. Because I just didn't understand loving. I just didn't understand genuine depth of feeling at all. And I've been here a while, and it is still new for me. Daily, I learn more about feeling. I learn more about me. Things that were all right for me to do a year or two ago are not all right for me to do today. I am trying to live a better life, I'm trying to repair the wreckage of my past. And that's what an amends is. It is not just running around telling people I'm sorry for what I did. It's trying to heal the messes I made. In the fifth chapter, it says our adventures before and after made clear through pertinent ideas that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives, that no human power could, and that God could and would if we were sought. I believe that saying God could and would if he were sought means seeking God on a continual basis. I don't think it means when I got here I asked God to heal me up and I got healed and everything's ducky. I think that we go on because I believe if we don't grow, we die. If we don't grow, we go. We cannot stand still in recovery. We either continue to go forward or we go backwards and we get sick and we go out the door. The book says, the insanity will return and I will drink again. It does not say I'll go crazy when I drink. It doesn't say I'll get drunk and go nuts. It says the insanity of alcohol will return and I will drink again. And that's the part that just goes around in my mind all the time. I know that if I start getting crazy, it's because I'm not working my steps. And if I'm not working my steps and I get crazy, the alcohol will take me back. Because I will have to have something to ease the pain. I will have to drink. And once I put alcohol in me, I have an allergy to it and it grows from there. And I'll be right back where I was, only worse, because it is progressive. So I did my fifth step, and then I got to the sixth step. And the sixth step is a little bitty step. It's an easy little step, except for entirely and all. If they would have left entirely and all out of that step, we could all do real well with it. But it is hard to entirely give all of anything to anybody. And I had to do that with reservation. I had to come to a place where I understood that God relieves me at his leisure. God relieves me as he can. God does not take anything out of me until he puts something back in me. So if I am willing, if I bring a willingness to my recovery, to my God, to my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'm willing to listen, then God gives me something to put back in there where those defects were. And that's good. That's good. That's like healing it up instead of closing it up and leaving the poison in there. I got to the eighth step. I had to make a list. And pretty much the way that I see it, the first step handles issues for me. The eighth step handles people for me. And then I had to go and make amends to the people that I had harmed. Except when it would injure them or others. Now that's interesting, and I have a real belief about that. I don't believe I'm an other. And I think that people who go around believing that they are an other rob themselves of some real freedom, because that's what I get here is freedom. It is progressive. I am more free today than I was a few years ago. I expect to be more free in 10 years than I am now. But I have to remember that it's not going to be painless. It wasn't painless when I hurt those folks. It wasn't painless when I took from them. It wasn't painless when I harmed them. And it is not going to be painless for me to try to heal it up. And when I go and make those amends, there are going to be people that don't want to see me. There are going to be people that are not pleased to talk to me. There are going to be people that do not forgive me and do not treat me nice and do not feel better about me when I'm gone. But it is not about their side of the street, it's about mine. If I clean up my side of the street, I get to be happy, joyous, and free. And I am free every day. Some days I'm happy and joyous too, but I am always free. And that comes from coming here and doing what I have to do on a daily basis. The tenth step, I think, is designed for immediate difficulties, for things that go on in my day. It's just a cleansing, just an overhauling of whatever I've been doing. But I don't think it takes the place of the other steps. I have had to go back and do another fourth step, more than one. And that's because more has been disclosed to me. And my big book tells me that more will be disclosed to us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. And I believe that the more prepared I am, the more able I am, the more willing I have become, the thicker skinned I have gotten, I have been able to stand more pain. I've been able to look at myself more deeply. And the more I see, the more I see I have to fix. The more I see that I have to get some help and heal the wounds. Because a lot of the things that I perceive as acceptable behavior have changed. They have changed. I do not perceive my mode of operation the same today as I did a few years ago. And I hope that's growth. I hope that we call that growth. The 11th step is a constant attempt at growing closer to my higher power. And I do that, I'm really profound. I'm not an esoteric kind of person. I know we've got a lot of folks that, you know, that get way out there and God just doesn't send me a fax. I seek the will of God in my life, but He does not fax it to me or call me on the phone. If I don't come where you guys are, I don't hear what I need to hear. I believe that God designed Alcoholics Anonymous for alcoholics because we could hear each other. And He speaks to us through each other if we are willing to listen. He touches us through each other. And if I avoid you, if I don't come to you, if I get too well for you, then I'm not going to get what I need, and I'm not going to continue to grow. And if I don't continue to grow, I'm going to go right on back out the door. Some people do. Some people with a lot of time do. And everybody that I've ever heard talk about that always says they believe it is the spiritual place that suffers. We get too well. We know too much. Well, I don't want to get there, and I'm certainly not there now. And if any of you ever hear me sound like I think I know too much, please point it out to me. I'll appreciate it greatly. I believe that 12-step work is just about everything that we do with each other. I don't think that it's working with wet drunks totally. I think that's important. But I think this is 12-step work. I think doing what I am asked to do when I'm asked to do it is 12-step work. I think putting the chairs away, picking up the coffee cups, making coffee, answering the phone when I don't want to talk on it, calling people when I haven't seen them at a meeting, giving people rides, whatever it is that helps us to interact with other alcoholics, and they don't have to be people junior to us in time. There's a lot of people with a lot of time that get in hot water, but people live and they die, people marry and divorce, people get and lose jobs, and boyfriends, God knows, will come and go. Things happen, and we all have to live through them. And if we do not support one another in the things that happen to us, then all of us are going to stay in trouble. The best way I know to spend the day is to get with one of you all and get out of me and hear what's going on with you. You know, and if you've lost your job and I'm bitching about mine, mine looks real good to me if I've still got a paycheck. That's just how it is. If we share what's going on with us, we stop being so selfish and self-centered. Because those characteristics don't go away. I don't believe that I was struck unselfish and unself-centered. I believe that if I do everything I'm supposed to do on a daily basis, I'm less selfish and less self-centered than I was when I got here. And hopefully, I will continue to be less and less, and more the things that I want to be, that God will make me more and more valuable as a tool and as a human being. You know, there's a lot of really, really nifty things that have happened to me along the way in recovery, and they're so funny, and I couldn't laugh about them when they happened. I got to go back to school. I had no education because I kept getting married from the time I was an infant. So I didn't go to school. When I stopped drinking, I went and took the GED test, and I scored real well, and I got a scholarship to the community college. So I was going to get a little education, and that really, really excited me. I was taking prescription drugs, you know, and I was high, but I was able to go. And when we came to Florida, I continued to go to school. Mm-hmm. And I was taking a computer class. I don't know, we got a handful of young people in here, maybe. I was born in a world where there weren't any computers, and people who were not born in a world that didn't have computers probably won't identify with this at all. But I didn't understand computers at all. When I was first exposed to them, they scared me. I didn't understand how they worked. And I might as well have been beamed out of the realm. But I had to take this class because it was a required class. And I had to take it for my degree. So I'm going to this class, and I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I'm looking around, and I'm real early in recovery. I guess maybe my first year. And I had not learned any of those simple things that we know after a while. So I was sitting there thinking that, that maybe if I hide back here, they won't realize I'm here. I went to see my sponsor, and I told her, I don't know what I'm going to do. If I'm going to fail this class, tell me, I don't know what to do. And my sponsor would tell me, she'd say, I don't know what you should do. Have you told your teacher? I can't do that, you know, I don't know. I couldn't do that. And she'd sit back and she'd have another cup of coffee and she'd say, I don't think you're going to fail. And I said, you tell me what to do. And she said, I don't know, I think you're going to fail. You know, after you hear that from them for a while, you get really tired of listening to it. They talk to you so bad sometimes. Talk to you like you're 4 years old. And I'm sitting there and I said, tell me what to do. I don't know what to do. And she says, I don't know what to do. I don't know anything about computers. But your teacher does. And if you'll go tell her that you don't, she might explain it to you. And, she wasn't real nice about it either. So I went over there, and I waited until the end of the class. And this is bad. I've been keying through the whole quarter. Now, we're in a place where I should be almost finished with my term project, and I have not started it because I don't know how. And when the class is over and everybody's filing out, I make sure nobody's around. I go up and I talk to this lady, and I told her, I'm just not getting it. I just don't know. She says, where are you? And I said, well, I'm on the right page. And she smiled, and she said to me, well, we're going to have to look at this from another place for you, aren't we? And she sat down with me on her own time, and she explained to me what it was from the place I was to the place she was, and she gave me the bridge, and she helped me get there. And I got an A in that class, but the A wasn't what I got. What I got was I learned how to ask for help. And that's all we have to do. All we ever have to do. God puts whatever I need in my path. But first I have to ask. He does not shower manna down here. He expects me to hoe so that my garden will grow. He expects me to reach out to the people who have the value, who have the knowledge, who have the tools, and find out how they got them, what they did to get them, and how they're keeping them. And if I'm willing to ask you, you tell me. Everybody I've ever asked, I have never asked, inside and outside of AA, I've never gone since recovery started for me, and asked anyone for help, and I've gotten it. And sometimes the help I get is then sending to somebody else who does know. But isn't that what we need? You know, it's not frightening to not know. It is not. It's just information. Nobody owns information. Nobody owns that. It's just a body of, and it's everywhere. And nobody has it all. But if we all share what we have, then we'll all have a whole lot more. It's what we do with our pain here with the Lord. And we can share that, and then we all seem to have a whole lot less. Works in reverse, I guess. I go to a lot of meetings. I still go to a lot of meetings. I think that that's important. I do not feel right when I don't. Sometimes my work schedule gets out of hand. I work a lot of overtime, and I can't make meetings like I'm used to, and I get down to maybe one or two a week, and I get real uncomfortable in my skin again. I'm not hearing what I need. I'm not doing what I need to do. First thing I know, I'm not sleeping like I should. I'm not eating like I should. I'm getting real angry with the people around me. Getting real, real tired. All the things that I am supposed to do to take care of myself, I stop doing one by one immediately when I stop going to meetings as often as I should. I don't know why that is. I've asked my sponsor, and she says she thinks it's just a sickness, and it doesn't matter why. And that's another point that's real important to me. People who spend a lot of time on why am I an alcoholic, why am I like this, why does it work like that, but why people don't seem to enjoy as much happiness as the where do we go from here people. And so it's real important to me to just find out what to do about the problem. Identify the problem, find out what the solution is, and then take the action to solve it. And it's real simple, and it's all in the steps, and they are constant. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a constant daily application to living. And if we stop working them, we stop growing, we stop getting better, and we stop being happy, joyous, and free. Thank you very much for letting me share this.